Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
In the last episode, we had a wide-ranging and somewhat meandering critical discussion about presuppositional apologetics. Today, Andrew and I are going to follow up on that conversation with a more focused look at the presuppositional method. So, Andrew, it seems to me that presuppositionalists have two aspects or two sides to their method. And for the sake of this discussion, we can call these aspects the negative and positive apologetic. Their negative apologetic is largely deconstructive. It involves showing a person that their non-Christian worldview is ultimately inconsistent or even incoherent. That is, that it's unable to account for some broad feature or features of reality. And here, presuppositionalists, it seems to me, like to focus on those aspects of reality that are related to human cognition and rationality in particular. So things like reason and logic and intelligibility. And this is all well and good. And I actually think that some of them do a very good job here. The late Greg Bahnsen, for example, who was a student of Van Til's, was really skilled at this in live debate settings. But of course, the problem here is that this kind of negative apologetic is not at all unique to presuppositionalism. That is, it doesn't distinguish presuppositional apologetics as a method. And this is because pointing out the problems or inconsistencies with non-theistic conceptual schemes has always been a staple, has always been a part of the classical method of apologetics. So when presuppositionalists engage in their negative or deconstructive apologetic, they are to that extent doing classical apologetics. So I'd like us to turn to consider their positive side, the positive side to their apologetic. But before I do that, do you have any thoughts on what I'm calling this negative aspect of the presuppositional method? And do you agree that when they actually get to doing this deconstructive apologetic, they're pretty much just doing classical apologetics?
Yeah. So in terms of the negative side as well, I think it's kind of, for me, difficult to distinguish. I fully agree with you. There's the two sides of it, but they're really two sides of the same coin. And I don't know how you can throw away one side of the coin without throwing away the other. Because the method that they use usually for this negative side, yes, there's a whole lot of logical, you know, back and forth and whatnot, but there's kind of a selective use of logical fallacies, for example. And this will show up a little bit later when we're talking directly about the transcendental argument. But a lot of the negative sort of, like you said, deconstructive elements to it are when they'll, for example, Scott Oliphant on page 24 of this book, Covenantal Apologetics, he'll argue that, you know, everybody reasons circularly and that's not a problem. And so, you know, he moves on from there. He's doing that because he's saying, of course I reason circularly about the Christian worldview. And then he turns around on page 84 and he criticizes somebody else for using circular reasoning. And so there's a little bit of like a, I would say, inconsistent usage of a lot of these things. And, you know, we'll get into why they don't think that it's so inconsistent. But the fact of the matter is that that, I think, impacts the negative side of what they're doing, if for no other reason than because it's oftentimes, to me, looks more like nitpicking that's just inconsistent. So,
yeah. All right. Well, if presuppositionalism is going to offer a distinctive and unique apologetic method, then I think it's going to have to be found in the positive case that they make for Christian theism. Because like I said, when it comes to making that negative deconstructive case, they're just doing what classical apologists do. And indeed, I think we do find something distinctive, at least being claimed here by the presuppositionalists. And when it comes to demonstrating the truth of Christian theism, for example, Cornelius Van Til, who is the father of the presuppositional method, insists that there is but one and only one proof that can be given. And that proof is what he calls the transcendental argument. And this is where I want us to focus our attention today. So let's start off by unpacking this notion of a transcendental argument. Andrew, let me kick this to you. Can you talk to us about the nature of a transcendental argument in general? Where does it come from, and what are its distinguishing features?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a long history of the transcendental argument. One of the philosopher Immanuel Kant's early works is just, I forget the full name of it, but transcendental argument is in the name. And as far as I'm aware, he's the first one to actually propose this. And it's important because you'll read in the presuppositionalist literature a whole lot of references to the work of Kant. So, for example, there's actually a pretty sizable part wherein Oliphant, again, in that book, talks about Immanuel Kant. Reasons for Faith is the book. And he outlines the method that Kant is putting forward. And I bring that up to say that Kant's transcendental argument that he puts forth by name is almost never what the presuppositionalist is going to be referring to. So rather, there's kind of this bare bones kind of transcendentalism that shows up. And that really is what we need to understand if we're going to get into like what these presuppositionalists are getting at. And to that degree, there's kind of a broad brushstroke modus ponens form of an argument that is really the transcendental argument here. And modus ponens, for those who don't know, modus ponens is formally stated as if P, then Q. So if P is true, then Q follows. A good example would be if it's raining, then it's wet outside. Pretty standard modus ponens right there. So then you can see that, oh, wow, it's raining outside. Therefore, we are warranted to conclude, therefore, it's wet. Right. That's it's a pretty standard. Actually, it probably is the most basic form of logical reasoning. Now, the transcendental argument in a form of modus ponens usually runs something like, if we have knowledge, then there are certain necessary preconditions that must be filled. We have knowledge, therefore these necessary preconditions must be had. And that's the broadest brushstroke, I think, kind of treatment of what really is operating in the contemporary sense of a transcendental argument.
Okay, so it's basically an argument. Let me know what you think about this. It's an argument that starts with a premise about experience or knowledge, and then it argues for a necessary condition that makes that experience or knowledge possible.
Yeah.
I like the the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy definition. They write this. They say transcendental arguments are taken to be distinctive in involving a certain sort of claim, namely that X is a necessary condition for the possibility of Y, where then, given that Y is the case, it logically follows that X must be the case too. Again, that's from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. And then James Anderson, he's a professor at RTS, right?
RTS Charlotte.
RTS Charlotte. Okay, so he's close to you there.
Oh, yeah.
He describes a transcendental argument in his paper, If Knowledge, Then God. He describes it this way. He says, transcendental arguments purport to uncover what must be the case, or alternatively, what we must take to be the case, in order for various kinds of intentional operation. And here he's talking about individuating, predicating, perceiving, knowing to be possible. So that's Anderson's definition.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
The transcendental argument. Anything you want to say further on just the nature of this? I know you're more familiar with German philosophy, with Kant in particular. Maybe what kind of use did Kant make for transcendental arguments? And were they, do you think that these are critical for his philosophical position?
So Kant, I think I actually brought, Kant is, he's a little interesting on this point. He's sort of a basic first movement that hasn't fully worked its way out. And so because of that, there's a lot of sort of inconsistencies. If you have the Cambridge collection of Kant's works, that one volume is on religion and rational theology, that volume. And if you read sort of at the end of his life, he has a series of lectures that he gives on really what today we just call philosophy of religion. And he says things in there that sound very much like a classical theist. Almost none of it is something that just would on its face jump out at you and make you go, wait a second. No. You've broken with the medieval tradition. You've broken with the early church tradition. There's not really a whole lot there. Kant was the standard, especially in his day, a standard Lutheran thinker. But the fact of the matter is, you can read earlier works where he says things that kind of differ from that. He'll say things, for example, where he'll critique the idea of, this is a different philosophical issue, but he'll critique the idea of theodicy or rationalization of the problem of evil. And he'll say that that's impossible. You shouldn't do that. And then you can find theodicies in his work where, for example, the earthquake in Lisbon occurs and he then creates a theodicy to try to explain it. So yeah. He's really inconsistent on a lot of these points. So it would be difficult to say that Immanuel Kant's thought sort of preserved some kind of real usage of the transcendental argument. However, the use that the presuppositionalist is using is what's really the bare bones version of his development of the notion of the transcendental. And for Kant, the notion of the transcendental comes from, it's mainly developed in his major work, The Critique of Pure Reason. And the sort of, you know, philosophy 101 intro to this would be to say that there's a phenomenal noumenal distinction, that there's a difference between the appearance of reality as we perceive it and the reality that that is in itself. That last phrase, in itself, is the really important part. So the noumenal realm is the in itself. The phenomenal realm is the realm of appearances. And so Kant is trying to show how the extra mental, the external world, comes into the mind and achieves the kind of intelligibility that it achieves. Now, it's a very sort of subtle move that he makes, because he says that there's the manifold of sense experience that comes before us. And this is on itself fundamentally meaningless, that it's just, it's unintelligible. It's just sense data, right? And that the body is physically interacting with it in that regard. And so we just have sensation. And for the Thomist, we largely agree with that. That sensation on its own is not what's intelligible. It's once sensation has been passed into the intellect via something called the phantasm, that the intellect receives that sense data and enlightens it by the act of the agent intellect and turns it into a concept. Well, Kant would say that enlightening process of turning that sense data into a concept, that enlightening process involves the mediation of the nature of consciousness itself, reason. Mm-hmm. Reason has a form to it. It has a structure to it. And that this form or structure is universal to humanity. And so when we have all of the different kinds of experiences that we have, essentially the degree of their intelligibility is made the way that it is by the agent intellect working. It imposes these forms of thought upon experience. So Kant has this line where he talks about the complete range of possible experiences contained within this transcendental.
Yeah.
And you got to keep in mind, this is a little bit maybe too much of a deep cut into the philosophy, but there's a guy, Leibniz, Gottfried Leibniz, that was a major German philosopher who was not systematic at all in his thought. And so after him, a whole bunch of philosophers showed up that tried to systematize his thought. And so he has this idea of monads, where in the monad, each monad has their own perspective on reality, and all perspectives play out together in harmony. And it's sort of like you could say that every one of us has a movie playing in our heads, and that every one of us has this movie playing in this perfectly synchronized form.
So that we're all established harmony.
Exactly. It's a pre-established harmony where it's the movie's all playing for us in the exact same order, but we have a different vantage point on the movie, right? So we're all at the same time spot on the movie, but we all have a different vantage point. And so Kant takes that and he's like, all right, so Leibniz is the one that introduces the idea that all possible experience is anchored to this preloaded consciousness of the movie playing itself out. And Kant comes to that and says, all right, there's a little bit of a contingency here. And so the contingency is precisely in we don't know what sense experience is going to come our way, but still the range of its intelligibility is preloaded into the mind. So there's only a certain amount of kind of intelligible experiences that could be generated by the intellect. So the ground of all possible intelligibility is preloaded in this transcendental schematic that just imprints itself on sensory experience as we go on.
So the transcendental argument comes from Kant, and then it's taken up by Van Til. And there's a certain twist that's put on it by presuppositionalists. The problem here is that, as far as I'm aware, and as far as I've heard others, like, again, James Anderson, who's trying to defend Van Til and the transcendental argument in this paper that he writes, Van Til himself never really formulated the transcendental argument, like in a philosophically rigorous way. So all we're left with are statements that he makes about it, claims that he makes about it. For example, James Anderson tells us that there's three distinct claims that he makes about a presuppositional transcendental argument. And here I'm talking about he being Van Til. The first is that there is only one argument. So whatever this argument is, it's one argument that is the transcendental argument. Number two, he says that the one argument gets us all the way to Christian theism in particular, not just to a generic theism. And finally, that this one argument yields to a certain conclusion, not just a probable conclusion. So these are some serious claims. And again, the problem is we're never given that argument by Van Til himself. A quote that I think comes closest is in The Defense of the Faith on page 298, where Van Til writes this. He says, "The best, the only, the absolutely certain proof of the truth of Christianity is that unless its truth be presupposed, there is no proof of anything. Christianity is proved as being the very foundation of the idea of proof itself," end quote. Again, that's in The Defense of the Faith on page 298. So that's the best that I can do, Andrew. Were you able to find anything in Van Til where he comes closer than that to describing exactly or to kind of formulating the transcendental argument that he has in mind?
No, he repeats more or less that exact same idea in a number of different places, that exact same phrasing. So in the edition I got, I think this is like 2011, okay, Scott Oliphant's the editor, but you've got like that edition. Page 125 to 126, he says essentially the same thing. And then you have various statements in this book, A Christian Theory of Knowledge, to the same effect. And he always states it in that kind of informal way that also seems to be drawing a conclusion from things that he's been saying up until this point. And a lot of times, for example, in this one, he's citing either theoretical interlocutors or somebody who he's actually had a debate with. So if you've read The Defense of the Faith, he opens up with this long sort of response to a whole bunch of people that he's debating.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
And that he sort of has arguments within the Reformed tradition. And he continually interacts with these people, and he deploys this variation, like these statements about the transcendental argument, as a response to them, as if this is just the conclusion that we need to draw. And again, as if it's bringing everything together. And yet he really hasn't he definitely hasn't formalized it, and he's barely developed, if at all, the ideas that he's drawing, he's bringing to a conclusion. So you're never going to find, I think, something more concrete than that.
Yeah. So it seems to me, I mean, the basic argument is, in order to account for rationality or intelligibility or logic or reasoning, we must presuppose the truth of Christian theism. I mean, it seems to me that's the heart of the claim.
Yeah. Well, to quote him on page 272 here, he says, "Unless a man presuppose the God and the Christ of the scriptures, he cannot identify himself nor any fact of this world, or even relate any fact to any other fact. Predication is meaningless except upon the presupposition of the truth of Christianity. The unbeliever can intellectually understand, or cannot No, the unbeliever can intellectually understand this. It is the task of the Christian apologist to present the absolute contrast between predication carried forth upon Christian premises and the predication carried forth upon the premise of human autonomy."
So, okay, good.
Yeah, another statement to that, the same effect.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, that's kind of the best we can do to kind of just introduce the Vantillian presuppositional argument, or the presuppositional transcendental argument. You sent me a paper from James Anderson, If Knowledge, Then God, where Anderson tries to take these statements that these informal statements that Anderson makes throughout his writings, that Van Til makes throughout his writings, and then he tries to use them to then offer some various formulations of the argument. So at this point, let's turn to a critique. Let's talk about what's wrong with this supposed presuppositional transcendental argument, or the method of transcendental argumentation. So what are your thoughts on this, Andrew? If you had to critique this, what do you see as the main issues here?
Well, so there's a lot of, it's kind of hard to distill it into just a few points. So one of the leading points is something we actually talked about last week, which is there's a kind of profound ambiguity in terms of what precisely is having to be presupposed. The quote that I read here, it is simultaneously the God of Scripture and also Scripture. And you see that repeatedly. And there's also the language. So Anderson, for example, in that article, it's a fantastic article. Again, it's available on his website. You can get a pre-published version of it there. I think you can find a published PDF version online as well.
I'll link the article in the description of this video as well, if anyone's interested in grabbing it themselves.
Yeah, it's well worth your time if you want to understand this. It's probably, I think, probably about the clearest I've ever seen this presented. He's a really good scholar there. So the thing is, he's trying to, in that paper, synthesize the work of Alvin Plantinga, probably the goat of Christian analytic philosophy, for better or worse. And so Plantinga is not exactly a presup. He has, I think, to my knowledge, two references to Van Til that just kind of say that Van Til went too far. And but he's still saying, though, I think he still recognizes himself as being largely in the same lineage. And so for Plantinga, he puts forth what's called a noetic structure. And a noetic structure is composed of sort of propositions stacked hierarchically. It's a system of propositions, if you will. And these propositions, a proposition is, you know, like the claim, if P, then Q, something like that, right? Like a proposition is a logical statement, claim about the truth, right? And so you have a system of propositions that are woven together into this noetic structure that he calls it. And certain propositions are more fundamental than others. And the most fundamental propositions are what he calls properly basic propositions. But nevertheless, these are still propositions. So if we're talking about the ground of our understanding in a Plantingian sense, then what we're talking about are propositions. Now, if you're talking about a transcendental in the Kantian sense, which is an important thing to bring up, because Van Til is writing prior to Plantinga for the most part. And Van Til seems to be, he's explicitly referring to sort of this Kantian this Kantian kind of language, this Kantian notion of a transcendental, that is a precondition of intelligibility. That's not a proposition as a ground of intelligibility. It's a grounding precondition of intelligibility. So the difference would be that a proposition is already intelligible, right? And so you would have already taken certain already intelligized propositions as your ground as properly basic in a Plantingian sense. Van Til wants to go back even further to say, well, what's the ground of intelligibility as such, which is going to be grounded in this transcendental framework of the understanding? Now, if that's the case, you don't even have propositions you can fall back on if you're going to be actually pushing this to hold to a truly Kantian sense of the language here. And you'll hear presuppositionalists, including Van Til, kind of all over the place. Sometimes they seem like they're talking about propositions. Sometimes they seem like they're talking about the grounds of intelligibility, as such. And it's a massive distinction there that needs to be clarified, because I think it's pretty clear if we're talking about the preconditions of intelligibility such that you can't even form propositions without this, then clearly the Bible doesn't give us that, because the Bible isn't preloaded in our consciousness. Our transcendental framework is not the Bible, right? It's not pre-conscious. It's very intentionally conscious. The whole point of the gospel is to engage with what we're conscious of. And so that clearly would make him seemingly have to be falling on more of this propositional notion, right? And so I think Anderson's safe in doing that and sort of moving there to say, okay, let's talk about properly basic beliefs, not transcendental frameworks necessarily. Problem is, again, Van Til's all about the transcendental framework. You go into Oliphant. Oliphant has significant portions. He draws from Plantinga a lot too, but he has significant portions where he talks about the Kantian framework. You know, so it's a common thing. So what's really going on is you could say that we have this this blockage, if you will, in our consciousness, whether it be in our ability to make sense of things via the transcendental framework, or whether it be our inclusion of bad propositions in our lines of reasoning that are produced by our rebellious autonomy against God. And so the presuppositionalist is committed to the idea that we have, this is part of the negative deal that you were talking about earlier, is committed to the idea that you have adopted a whole bunch of wrong ways of thinking that are in rebellion with God. These are what we adopt via our autonomy or our freedom. And so we just simply do not presuppose the Christian worldview, but rather presuppose something that goes contrary to it. And so the commitment is that every single other belief will therefore necessarily end up in some logical problem. The transcendental argument says, because we have the proper ground, the only possible ground, as Van Til is fond of saying, the only possible ground of this intelligibility, we're the only ones that can give not just true statements, but an account of our true statements. And within that, again, the ambiguity of the first part, I need to be clarified, because if it's in the transcendental sense, if sin, the noetic effects of sin are affecting us in the transcendental sense, the gospel cannot fix that, because I can't even read the gospel if that's right. The case. Because nothing could be intelligible. So then, of course, you have to have this invention called common grace. I find it kind of this might be a controversial thing to say, but I find it to be a notion that's conspicuously not present in the early reformers and kind of shows up with the emergence of this guy, Abram Kuyper. Abram Kuyper actually takes this all the way. And here's where probably my biggest problem with the whole line of reasoning is, and this gets carried all the way through to Van Til. Abram Kuyper on page 55 of this book, Wisdom and Wonder, writes that, no, the actual darkening of sin lies in something else entirely. Because he's been entertaining the idea of sort of the moral darkening of sin. And there's now he wants to shift to an epistemological darkening. He says, sin's darkening lies in this, that we lost the gift of grasping the true context, the proper coherence, the systematic integration of all things. Now we view everything only externally, not in its core and essence, each thing individually, but not in its mutual connection with and in their origin from God. So we don't understand things in their total context. And then he even says that now we stand, because of that, we stand before creation as blind and deaf as a dog stands before creation, which is pretty straightforwardly false, right? Obviously, there's a difference between human intelligibility and an animal intelligibility. Well, so they add the aspect of common grace. There has to be this, we have a general sense of intelligibility, and that's just sort of like, I guess you could say, a gracious infusing in my consciousness, a certain amount of the Christian worldview that allows me to be able to have just enough intelligibility here. Well, part two. I know that was a long part, but part two here. So the next part is, with this that must be presupposed, is it the Trinity? Is it the Christian worldview? What precisely?
Before you get to that, I'm just reflecting on part one. So how do we account for the fact that non-believers know some things? It sounds like Kuiper is going in for common grace, as you just explained. But Bahnsen, he's the guy I'm most familiar with. His book is the one I read last, so it's the one that's most fresh on my mind. But Bahnsen actually says that we actually know the truth. We actually know the truth of the Christian worldview, but we're suppressing that truth. Yep. We're holding it down. And so when we come up for air, when we're able to have what seems to be genuine knowledge of reality, when we're able to do mathematics, when we're able to do physics and biology and whatnot, Bahnsen says it's because we are subconsciously borrowing from that knowledge that we're suppressing. So it's interesting, as you're talking about this notion of common grace, it seems to me that Bahnsen actually is trying to account for it by the notion of suppressed knowledge. So doesn't seem to be a unified story that we have from the presuppositionalist, because you make a great point. I mean, if it's a total package, and if we must preconceive and presuppose conceptually the truth of Christian theism before we can know any truth, then how do we start off as an unbeliever and then come to the faith? How do we even recognize the Bible, for example? How do we even approach the Bible, read it, and understand what it says? It seems like there's a whole lot of rationality that seems to be that we have to have on board in order to even, you know, operate in these basic ways by identifying what is the Bible versus, let's say, the Quran, and what does the Bible say? How do we understand the Bible? Basic interpretive skills that we bring to the text. So what you're saying there about common grace, I think, is really, really important, because there has to be some story that we tell that allows the unbeliever to transition worldviews. And it seems like in order to do that, we've got to already have some rational capacities that are trustworthy. And I think you're 100% right there. So I would just point to a distinction between someone like Kuiper, apparently, who leans on common grace, and another guy like Bahnsen, who's leading on the idea of suppressed knowledge. So there has to be some account, basically, for how it is that unbelievers apparently have enough rationality to be able to consider the Christian worldview in the first place and even approach the text of Scripture. So I think that's a point well made.
Appreciate it. And they appeal to the image of God, the notion of the image of God here. So yeah. The image of God is marred. It's not gone. Right. It's not completely removed. One thing I do want to bring up about that, this is kind of a little bit of a bugbear for me, but the image of God doesn't necessarily mean in Christian tradition has not historically always meant our rational faculties. That's kind of more of a Augustinian type idea. And I don't want to bash Augustine at all here, but it also very likely meant at a minimum, at least the additional element of it was that it meant sort of the authority of God to rule, which is not necessarily to say that it's the same as the consciousness of God. And so there's a huge link here. Anderson quotes Van Til, I forget which book, in the opening, I think it's the very opening page, maybe first two pages of his article, where Van Til literally says that, and he says this actually a number of places, that really, the problem is we cannot possess complete comprehensive knowledge of all things. So therefore, we need God to understand all things and explain it to us. And there's, as I've mentioned before, there's sort of an equation between God's understanding and human understanding. God's mm-hmm. is just more comprehensive. And historically, theologically, that's not the right way to measure this. And usually the image of God is invoked to sort of blur the lines between human and divine consciousness. And the reality is, historically, theologically speaking, it's instead that the knowledge of God is completely different from the knowledge of man, right? That these are categorically different sorts of things. Yeah. God knows us as the cause. God knows things as the cause. We know things as perceiving it. We receive the knowledge. And this isn't just the facts, I guess you could say, to speak in a way that I'm a little bit uncomfortable with it, but the facts that we perceive are not even perceived in the same kind of categorical way. In a way, you could say by analogy, and I used this example last week, so I think it's just useful to understand what's going on here. So if I say, Anthony, that I know you, and I also say that my dog knows you, right? These are both true statements. The clear statement, though, is, or clear point is, that we don't know you the same way. I know you in the way that's proper for me as a human. He knows you in the way that's proper for him as a dog, right? Yeah. But that's not to say that you are, that this knowledge is the same sort of thing. And it's not like I can just add the same quality of the dog's knowledge until I finally build up to human knowledge, right? It's not like I can just, it's not a quantitative difference. It's a qualitative difference. And it's the same thing between us and God's knowledge. It's not that we can just add human understanding to reach this totalizing point of absolution. And then that's the understanding of God. Coincidentally, that is the idea of a lot of the German idealists.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, and these are the guys that were constantly teetering on the brink of pantheism. Van Til's not a pantheist. But that's the problem already, is that human consciousness and divine consciousness are radically different things, qualitatively different. To use Kierkegaard's phrase, they are infinitely qualitatively different, right? So this is a huge point that needs to be stressed, because it's not just that God understands everything, and so therefore he's the necessary precondition for intelligibility in that regard. It's rather, even if he does understand everything, which he does, spoiler alert, but even if he does understand everything, that does nothing for human consciousness.
It doesn't help us.
Yeah, it's because it's qualitatively distinct.
So it's not like we can just map on to God's understanding of the world. It's not like we just take, we somehow plug into God's conceptual analysis of things, so we can conceptually see the world the way he does, and thereby know that we have the right worldview, because that would assume a univocal understanding of God's knowledge, that his knowledge is something like a conceptual scheme in the human sense.
But Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup, just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
But that's just not the case. God's knowledge is executive, right? God knows because he knows what he's doing. His knowledge is causative, and our knowledge is, of course, receptive. We know things because we are in touch with being. But my point right now is this, and I want to move on to your second critique. But my point is this: no matter how we explain the knowledge that the unbeliever obviously has, right? No matter how we explain it, whether it's because the unbeliever is in God's image, or because there's common grace, or because the unbeliever has suppressed knowledge, no matter how we explain it, it seems to me that as long as there's something there, some touch point, then we have some kind of a common ground.
Yeah.
And if you have some kind of common intellectual ground, then guess what? You can run the classical method.
Yeah.
So in accounting for the knowledge that people who aren't Christians obviously have about the world, it seems like the accounts that they supply, again, no matter what that account might be, it's almost always enough to just import the whole classical method, to justify the whole classical method. Because the only way you can preclude the classical method of apologetics is to argue that each of our worldviews are utterly incommensurable, right? That there is no overlap and that there is no common ground. So I just want to point that out, because I think it's a massive problem. And it's not the problem that I want us to focus on here. We're thinking about the transcendental argument in particular here. So with that said, I just kind of put that on the table. We can walk away from it, and let's turn to your, I think you had a second critique of the presuppositional transcendental argument.
Yeah, and so a lot of this is still sort of building to sort of get to the ability to even critique this thing, because I think what you just said is helpful to clarify something real quick. And that is, the listeners probably no doubt noticed that there's a lot of philosophical jargon being tossed about. We're talking about transcendentals. K. Scott Oliphant in his commentary on, I believe, the defense of the faith in here, makes the remark that, or in his footnotes, he makes the remark that Van Til is trying to take the theology of Calvin and translate it into the language of Hegel, for example. And one thing on that before I go, well, two things.
Why would anyone want to do that?
Hey, I love it, man. Come on. I love Hegel. Come on. But anyway, the thing is, there's terms like the absolute that get thrown around. Aquinas will use a term like absolute somewhat sparingly, but you can find it in Aquinas's works. You can find, I would guess you could find it in Calvin, but it doesn't show up with the same kind of prominence until sort of this 20th century time, you know, with Van Til and whatnot. And the use of the term absolute itself is the Hegelian idea of God. And Oliphant has a line in the footnotes where he says, now, obviously, Van Til did not mean this in the same way that Hegel did, and then just moves on, which leaves me having no idea how Van Til actually meant it, right? Because all I have is the Hegelian notion, and this actually, the Hegelian notion largely follows from a kind of transcendental argument, because what the absolute is for Hegel is that highest unifying principle of consciousness that brings order to all things, right? To all consciousness. And so, to all reason. And so you must have this if there is to be a rational order for consciousness. And that really kind of looks like a lot of what the presuppositionalist is trying to get to. And I'll make this point in every critique I'll offer of the transcendental argument and of the presuppositionalist method. And that is to say that the absolute there has not transcended the human. That categorically, if we're talking about the absolute principle of unity necessary to bring harmony to the order of reason in the human mind, then that point is transcendental. It is the highest point of the transcendental framework of the human consciousness. However, it has not transcended the human consciousness. And as I've just said a little bit ago, God is not the highest point within human consciousness. He is the highest point beyond human consciousness. Not even coherent to say he's the highest point, period. There just isn't anything higher than God, right? And so the point is, the point is that the terms here, transcendental, immanent, and transcendent, are important. Immanent is what's within, so you can think about what's within your house. Transcendental is the framework, so that you can think of like the walls of the house, the framing of the house. And then the transcendent is that which is beyond, and that's like what's beyond your house, what's outside your house. God is not within the house. He's not the framework of the house. He is what's beyond the house. And so with that being the case, I recognize there's a pushback that we can bring up maybe in a little bit, but the thing about that is God is the transcendent. If he's only the transcendental, he's still part of the house. And if the house here is the human, then that would mean he's still part of the human, and therefore Feuerbach is right, right? Ludwig Feuerbach is the guy that comes along and just says that theology is really just anthropology, right? Like this is a point that needs to be stressed, because we have not actually achieved knowledge of God. We've just achieved the highest knowledge of man. That's it. And so that's clearly a problematic theological claim to make, but that's just sort of one point to move on from. Because with the transcendental argument itself, as I was starting to say, there's a lot of philosophically contingent ideas that are at work here. And in fact, there's a whole history of philosophy that led us to this specific point. And this is just one stream within the history of philosophy. Basically, you start with Kant and you wind up here, and there's a Kantian influenced, really, you kind of could start with Descartes, because certainty is the issue that he introduces. And the transcendental argument is saying that knowledge is not possible if we can't have certainty about these things, because it's refuting the skeptic and the uncertainty that comes from the skeptic. Well, that's a Cartesian, that's introduced by Descartes, that kind of an idea. The medievals aren't really concerned with that. Right. In fact, the ancients aren't really concerned with that. Nobody's really concerned with that until Descartes. And then that issue of certainty pushes everybody until Kant comes up with his idea. And then Kant's idea revolutionizes everything. You follow it through Hegel, who gives us sort of the zenith of the terminology here. The Hegelian system sort of falls off and starts to wane. And then it gets revived a little bit in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And then the presuppositionalist is picking up in a largely analytic philosophical vein. This is another school that just popped up, right? And so the presuppositionalist is is following this Kantian line all the way to the present moment and insisting not just that I must presuppose, you know, the Trinity, not just that I must presuppose the Christian worldview, but there's a key word there, worldview. That mm-hmm. word does not exist before really the 19th century. It does get used, I think, Kant coins it, and it gets used just a little bit before the 19th century. It doesn't become a term until the late
19th century. Seems like Kant coins everything, doesn't he? I mean, he's the one that coined cosmological argument, yeah. teleological argument, ontological argument. These are all Kantian terms.
Yeah, we live and operate in a large way in sort of a Kantian a world with a Kantian default in our understanding. Yeah. And so the thing about that is, though, you're not just telling me I have to presuppose the Bible, as it turns out. You're not just telling me I have to presuppose the Trinity. You're also telling me I have to presuppose the Kantian understanding of reason.
That's right.
Because that did not exist beforehand. In fact, you're not just telling me that I have to presuppose the Kantian version of reason. I actually have to presuppose everything from Kant to Hegel to your contemporary analytic view of how reason operates. And frequently, that point is not only not addressed, but sort of asserted as if this is just what the Bible's teaching. But I defy anyone to come up with any usage in the Bible of the word worldview. Right.
Yeah.
This is a word that is incredibly, incredibly affixed to this default Kantian understanding that's made its way into our consciousness. As we use the term today, it largely is an invention of the 20th century. It's building off of what the German historicists, which were opposed to Galilean movement. I'm not trying to say Van Til's a Marxist, but you know, Marx is one of these kind of guys influenced by the German historicists as well. You can see about like historical materialism being a variation of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so like the German historicists are this tradition that follows Hegel that really make a whole lot of worldviews, because what they're pointing at is that reason evolves over time. For Kant, reason is this fixed structure. And then Hegel recognizes that, hey, reason actually evolves over time. And so he mm-hmm. has this theory of consciousness growing into its perfection. And so then the historicists come along and say, well, it's not growing into its perfection. It's just changing, right? And so the term worldview then gets affixed to this idea of this German historicist change. So worldview is just like, what did they believe about the world in this moment? What did they believe about the world in this moment? And so that's where the word shows up. And today, it gets flippantly assumed, oftentimes used in an almost meaningless way because we just throw it about so casually. Yeah. But it's a default point that you don't find it in Calvin. You don't find it in the early church. You certainly don't find it in the scriptures. And it's affixed to an epistemological system that don't tell me I have to presuppose this entire epistemological system that didn't come about and certainly wasn't even popular until the beginning of the 19th century.
Yeah, right? Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was done.
I was just going to say that's a great point. It's not just Christian theism that we have to presuppose, it seems, if we're going to run a presuppositionalist apologetic method. We have to presuppose a whole philosophical system that, as you're pointing out, is modern in terms of its characteristic, and it's especially Kantian or post-Kantian. And it's like I said in our last conversation, it seems to me that there is a deep link between anti-realism and presuppositionalism. Yeah. That you cannot take on board a philosophical realism, certainly not a scholastic or classical realism, and push these claims through as a presuppositionalist. It seems like you have to be an anti-realist of some sort, even an idealist or transcendental idealist like Immanuel Kant. So those are great points. So let me tell you, I have two criticisms here that in some ways will supplement the criticisms that you just gave us. So I have two problems basically with the presuppositional transcendental argument. My first problem is that it really has yet to be formulated in a way that distinguishes it from the classical approach. And if you remember, this is the same complaint I have with the negative apologetic within the presuppositional method, that every time it gets formulated, every time someone's actually out there trying to make this argument, it's always just part and parcel of a classical argument or of the classical approach. Because you can't just take any old transcendental argument off the shelf and argue for God using it and then claim that it's presuppositionalist. What the presuppositionalist needs is a version of the argument that explicitly argues for the conceptual presupposition of Christian theism as the necessary precondition of knowledge. That is to say, we need an argument here in which Christian theism is the epistemological precondition for the possibility of X, and not merely that Christian theism is the ontological precondition for the possibility of X. There's a difference between these two kinds of arguments. They both can be labeled transcendental, but there's a fundamental difference between them. Arguing that God is the ontological precondition for the possibility of X is just part and parcel of the classical method, broadly speaking, where God is posited as the ultimate explanation or as the ultimate ultimate account for some broad feature of reality that cannot explain or account for itself. This is just the classical method. In other words, it's not enough for the presuppositional apologist to argue that the existence of God is the necessary precondition for the possibility of rationality. That's just the classical method. If he is to have a distinct argument, a distinct method from the classical apologist, he must argue that Christian theism in particular is the necessary conceptual precondition, the necessary conceptual precondition for the possibility of rationality. He has to argue that the truth of Christianity must be presupposed in our minds or in our thinking for us to be able to reason at all. And I have never encountered this argument. As far as I'm aware, no one's even able has been able to formulate that argument. Van Til certainly never formulates that argument. And even with James Anderson, each of his reformulations of Van Til's, or attempted formulations, I should say, of Van Til's transcendental argument, each one of them in the paper that he writes demonstrates only that God is the ontological precondition for whatever features are in question in his argument. It does not demonstrate in any of his arguments that God is the epistemological precondition for X, whatever X may be that you're arguing for. Does that make sense, Andrew? I feel like this is a glaring problem. And so often I think that the confusion among presuppositionalists always boils down to the distinction between ontology and epistemology. If you're going to give an argument that's truly and uniquely presuppositional in nature, you have to argue for the epistemological precondition. You have to argue that we have to, in our minds, take on some kind of conceptual scheme in order to even be rational, in order to do logic, in order to reason, in order for there to be intelligibility. You can't just argue that God is the precondition for intelligibility or ration. There's a difference. One's ontological, one's epistemological. And if you're just, even if you're using something that's called the transcendental argument, but at the end of the day, it's making an ontological claim, then you are not giving a presuppositional transcendental argument. You're just giving some form, some version of a classical argument. That is what, that's what I see as the biggest criticism of this notion of a transcendental argument. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's pretty good. I think that's a pretty knockdown, I would argue. I'm biased, of course, but I would argue that's a pretty solid takedown. The listener hasn't probably read Anderson's article yet. So just to throw this out there for them, he gives four different formulations for it. And out of the four, three, if I remember, don't even mention the Trinity.
Only one does.
Yeah, and that's the first of the four. And so they end with this shows theism to be the case, to your point, right? And the one that says that the Trinity must be the case, I would argue, to further back up your point, pretty well fails on that level too. And this is really kind of telling. Anderson wrote a really good book on what is it, Paradox in Christian Belief, I think is the name of it. It was his second dissertation, because you know he's a double doctor. But it was his.
I did not know that. So what is he's PhD and philosophy and a theology degree?
Yep. He did his second PhD at the University of Edinburgh. I think his first one was in something like mathematics or something. Or computer science or something. I'm pretty sure he's a two PhD guy.
So clearly a smart guy.
Yeah, brilliant dude. But he on a personal level, really great guy too. But his formulation, I'll just read out the formulation that he gives in the paper to deduce the Trinity, and then I'll mention why this utterly fails. He says that, one,
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
The ontology of premise one, the ontology of the universe is such that A, unity is the ultimate principle, B, plurality is the ultimate principle, or C, unity and plurality are the ultimate principles. Now, keep in mind, A and B are mutually exclusive. So unity is the ultimate principle and it can't be plurality. B is that plurality is the ultimate principle and it can't be unity. Or C, unity and plurality are together, the co-ultimate principles. All right, that's the first premise. Premise two, if A is the case, then knowledge is impossible, which is to say, if unity is the ultimate principle, then knowledge is impossible. I don't know exactly how that's the case, because I would think the classical theist is more or less saying that that is the case because
that's
God
right.
is one.
That's
right. So then if B is the case, then knowledge is impossible. All right. These are just assertions. He doesn't argue for these. He's just, it's kind of taken on faith that the presuppositionalist will be able to show this. And then so premise four, knowledge is not impossible. Ergo, five, both unity and plurality, C, must be the case, right? And then so six, only Christianity gives us that. Now, he doesn't say only the Christian Trinity gives us that. He says only Christianity gives us that. And that's where the premise six here, only Christianity gives us this, which is sort of the conclusion of the argument. What's implicit in that is that unity and plurality, that the Trinity is this unity and plurality. But as I noted last week, this fails on a couple of levels. But the main one is God is not one in multiple. God is one in three. And if that is a little bit of an underwhelming response, there's a huge difference between a category and the things that are in the category. So I'm a human, but I am not humanity, right? So Anthony and I are two humans. We're not humanity, right? Mm-hmm. So the number three is an instance of the category of the multiple. It's not the category of multiple. God is not multiplicity as such. In fact, that would be heresy.
Right.
He is specifically three, all right? And not only that, he's the unity and the multiplicity here, but he's the unity and the triunity. That's the whole point. And so he's not the multiplicity per se. He is a specific instance of that, which is three. And if that's the case, then Christianity does not give us unity and multiplicity there.
That's right.
Now, here's
it's even worse than that, Andrew, because let's say that he can even formulate that argument where it's cogent and it doesn't imply heresy and it's philosophically sound. And somehow it accords with divine simplicity. Let's say that he can actually formulate that argument, right? Because right now you're arguing that the argument's just not cogent. It's not a good argument. But even if he could, still, here's what I want to say. I'm going to keep stomping the ground right now. It's because he's not given us a presuppositional argument.
Yeah.
This is not a transcendental argument that is presuppositional in nature. Why? Because he's arguing for some actual feature of reality, right? That you have unity and plurality. You have the one and the many. And he is arguing that in order to have this, in order for this to be, as a precondition for this, God has to exist. A triune God has to exist. What he is not arguing is that one has to have the conceptual scheme of a triune God in order to even understand the notions of unity and plurality, or to even understand the problem of the one and the many. He's not even trying to argue that. But what I'm saying is, even before we get into whether or not the argument is sound, what I'm saying is even there, he has utterly failed to give us something that is uniquely presuppositional in nature. It might be transcendental, but it's not presuppositional.
Right. And to further go back, so there's in logic, there's a difference between validity and soundness. So an argument is valid if it formally follows. So to go back to modus ponens that I mentioned earlier, modus ponens is if P, then Q. P is true, therefore Q is true, right? That would be, so we can take absurd examples. I could say, if I adopt this cat, then aliens will invade on Thursday, right? I did adopt this cat, therefore, logically, it formally follows that aliens will invade on Thursday. Well, that formally follows. That's maybe a valid line of reasoning, but it's not sound.
That's
because
right.
Because it's not true that if I adopt this cat, that then aliens will invade on Thursday, right? So the point is that it's, even if the formal line of reasoning follows there, and to your point, it still doesn't get him to the presupposition. But even if the formal line follows, it's still not sound.
It's still unsound.
And so that's the big problem there, because only Christianity gives us this. It doesn't. Also, you know what does give us unity and multiplicity in the highest one? Proclus's Elements of Theology, a Neoplatonist.
Yeah.
So it's not only Christianity that gives us this.
That's
true. In fact, there are other Neoplatonist philosophies that do this. And so...
So you can't just offer a transcendental argument. There's two things you have to do if you're Van Til. Number one, you have to actually give us an argument that's unique to presuppositionalism, which means it has to argue that God is the epistemological precondition, not the ontological precondition. But the second thing, as you're pointing out here, you have to give us a cogent argument that the Trinity is the presupposition. The Trinity is the conceptual presupposition for intelligibility or logic or what have you. So on both accounts, Anderson's attempt here fails on both accounts. He doesn't give us a unique argument that distinguishes it as a presuppositional argument, number one. Number two, he doesn't give us a cogent argument that one has to presuppose the existence of the triune God to account for the things he wants to account for. But there's a second criticism I have, Andrew, and just for the sake of time, let me throw it out there and so that we can react to this as well. A second problem that I have here with the notion of a presuppositional transcendental argument is that even if the presuppositionalist could formulate a uniquely presuppositional version of the transcendental argument, it would not, and it could not, demonstrate the actual existence of God. Now, the quick and dirty reason, so I say, is that such an argument would necessarily have to be a priori in nature. It would have to move or argue from some presupposed conception in the mind, and then conclude to a reality that exists outside the mind. But this is not a valid inference. You cannot go from thought to things. And to put it in the jargon of medieval philosophy, you cannot infer the existence of real being from a being of reason. You can't move from some cognition-dependent reality to a cognition-independent reality. And this is essentially Aquinas' critique of the Anselmian ontological argument, right? He says that at best, Anselm shows us that when we think about God, we must think of him as the greatest conceivable being. But this does not show that this being that we're thinking about actually exists outside of the mind. So the argument that Christian theism is the epistemological precondition for the possibility of rationality could at best, only establish God's necessary existence in the mind. It could not conclude to God's necessary existence in the extramental world. It could only conclude that it is necessary to think or to believe that God exists, and not that it's necessarily true that God actually exists. So even if it can be cogently formulated, it delivers only a conceptual necessity. It doesn't deliver an ontological necessity. And Kant's transcendental argument for causation, I think, is instructive here. According to Kant, causation is transcendentally necessary for human thought. Without the concept of causality, there could be no thought. Causality is necessary to the forms of our experience. But from this cognitional necessity. We cannot infer that the things in themselves, the things in the noumenal realm, the things that are independent of cognition, we cannot infer that they actually undergo causal relations. In Kant's terms, it's illicit to move from the synthetic a priori truths about the forms our experience must take to the actual existence of things outside of the mind. And likewise, presupposing the Christian worldview may be conceptually necessary for us to make sense of the world, and yet it remains possible, given anti-realism, that it tells us nothing whatever about the way the cognition-independent world really is. Because for all we know, our experience of rational intelligibility may be entirely cognition-dependent, just as for Kant, our experience of causality is cognition-dependent. So the world could be, at bottom, ultimately irrational and absurd. So something can be a necessary precondition for intelligibility, and yet not actually true. That's the problem with any kind of a priori argument. That's what Aquinas saw a long time ago. So even if the presuppositionalist is able to give us an argument that demonstrates that Christian theism is conceptually the precondition for rationality, that we have to presuppose conceptually in the mind Christian theism, it will not get us to the actual existence of God. It just will never get there. So it's even worse than we think, this so-called presuppositional transcendental argument, because even if it could be formulated, which I've never seen it formulated before, even if it could be, it could never get us to the existence of God, because you can't argue from God by starting in the mind. You just can't. So anyway,
and that's, I think that's a lot. That's, yeah. I think, one of the most damning points. You begin with Kant, you're stuck with Kant. And that's, and there's a line Etienne Gilson has. Etienne Gilson is a 20th century Thomist. He's somebody very well worth reading. And one of my favorite lines of his, it's a great axiom to sort of guide all religious study. And that is, he says that there is nothing pious in being wrong about God. I think we can extend this to say there's nothing pious in being wrong, period.
Yeah. Right.
And so within that, there's a lot of sort of pious sounding claims that are made, like this is the biblical assertion. And so you can point out that this doesn't get to, you know, this you start playing Kantian games, you win Kantian prizes, right? And if Kant cuts you off from the extra mental world, from the external world, and such that you cannot point to the, you cannot point to the real existence of God, you can only point to the imminent existence of God, at best to the transcendental framework, i.e. you're still not getting to God, right? If that's what you're going to be stuck with, then I'm sorry. Again, this is not Christian theism, and there's nothing pious about it. I'm not saying that Van Til wasn't saved or anything like that. I'm saying that he's using these categories crudely and therefore wrongly, and therefore speaking wrongly about our theological tradition. And so when the response is going to be something like, well, you know, the Bible says that we suppress the truth in unrighteousness, and that there's some sort of Christian command, if you will, right, that tells us that we must operate in accordance with this method here, this presuppositionalist method. The point that keeps showing up here is that, again, this is a Kantian line of reasoning, kind of even a bastardized Kantian line of reasoning, and it ends in a problematic conclusion that prevents us from even being able to get beyond the phenomenal perceptions to the real God who exists beyond them. That's a huge problem, and it's not something that the Bible ever even talks about. And so the pious-minded response that's going to say, yes, but I'm still going to follow the Bible, rather than having to, you know, I don't care about what Kant said, I don't care about what Hegel said, and to a certain degree, I don't even care that what Van Til said. I think the method is right, irrespective of whatever blunders Van Til may have made. Again, the problem here is still going to rest in the fact that, no, these objections and this line of reasoning only comes about if you take this line of philosophical reasoning from the beginning. It is not taught by the Bible. It is not even possible that it's taught by the Bible, because it doesn't exist before the Enlightenment era. And so there's a whole lot of just simplistic reasoning that sort of just ignores the fact that Calvin did not teach this. The early church did not teach this. They couldn't have taught this because they didn't have the vocabulary to teach this.
Yeah.
They didn't have the conceptual schema, ironically enough, to teach this. Right.
Yeah.
And so to your point there, I think that is an incredibly profound point, because the idea of God only being sort of this necessary conceptual thing, the postmodernist actually has been dealing with this for now 60 years. And that's exactly where this leads. If you don't actually just recognize that, no, there needs to be a transcendent, not merely transcendental proof for God.
Yeah. So I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but you know, I really do think these are the things that we've been talking about, you and I, specifically aimed at this notion of a transcendental argument that is presuppositional in nature. Because remember, I'm going to reiterate right now, if you're a presuppositionalist, you can't just offer any old transcendental argument. You have to offer a transcendental argument that is presuppositional in nature. And that means we have to make an argument that Christian theism, Trinitarian theism, is the epistemological precondition for the possibility of X. That's what the argument has to look like. Not that God is the precondition for the possibility of X, because classical theists believe that and argue that way too. That's part of the classical method. And then the second problem here that I think is just as devastating, because the first we could just say is a failure on the part of any presuppositionalist actually making that argument, right? I've never seen the argument. I think Dr. Howe, Richard Howe, we had him on last time, he'll say the same thing. He's never actually seen this argument that Christian theism is the epistemological precondition for the possibility of X. He's never seen that argument. I've never seen that argument. You've probably, I'm assuming you've never seen. Anderson doesn't give us that argument. Van Til doesn't give us that argument. Fine. If there's a presuppositionalist who does want to give us a distinctly presuppositional version of the transcendental argument, great. We'll look at it. Yeah, formalized. But there's a further problem, and that's the problem I just pointed out. If you are able to achieve that, then it's going to fail. It's going to fail because it's going to have to be a priori. You're going to have to start, by definition, for the presuppositionalist, you're going to have to start with some conceptual scheme in the mind. That's how that argument's going to have to run. It's going to have to start with something in the mind. But once you start in the mind, you can only end in the mind. You can't end outside of the mind to real being. And like I said, this is exactly what Aquinas saw with Anselm. Aquinas would have loved to have grabbed a hold of Anselm's argument if he thought it was legitimate, right? But he clearly saw this. You can't get to God if you start with premises that are only in your mind. If you're going to argue for God, you've got to argue you have to argue from real being, right? If you want to end in real being, you've got to start in real being.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Since 1981, Unbound has connected people like you with families worldwide on their self-directed paths out of poverty. A brighter future is possible for these families when we all walk together. Sponsor a child today, and you'll help a family take the first steps on their path. Change their future in just one click. Start walking with your new friend today at unbound.org/walk.